Hello there, one and all, rather. Welcome to this week's edition of the Weekly Chat. We've not been on air for a bit due to Ralph being ill and me getting burgled at my last office on a Friday lunchtime. Yeah, thanks for the sympathy, Ralph.
Laughing at your predicament, I was just saying that both of us were in dire straits and now we're back. Yeah.
Yes. So now that's why I'm in a different office, which is why there's a different background. But anyway, that's a story for another day. Anyway, I'm Peter, he's Ralph, so let's do this. This week we're going to talk about the oil major Shell, so the oil company Shell, threatening to leave the FTSE 100 and list in America, and why I think that EVs are not going to take over in the way everyone says they're going to. Something that I did touch on recently in a podcast, but I thought it was worth mentioning again because of certain developments as well. So, first of all, kicking off with Shell, the sort of basic story behind that is that Shell is not feeling that it's not getting valued as highly as it should do, especially in comparison to rivals in America, for instance. That's what the CEO is saying. Said he could get, if they left London, they could get better valuations in America because they are used to oil investment, implying that we're not. And also doesn't like getting hit by windfall taxes, which makes it more difficult for them as a company to make future investments. So that's what he's been saying. I mean, I think that he is not going to do that for a number of reasons. But what do you think, Ralph?
Well, whether he's going to do this or not, I found the mere suggestion that he might actually take Shell out of the FTSE and re-domicile in New York interesting or noteworthy, if that's the right word. Because what he said is he referenced everything you said, that basically Shell is going to attract a higher valuation, a better valuation, in accordance with many metrics, price earnings, price to book, on the New York Stock Exchange. But of course, what is behind this is that American-based investors, you use the phrase, are used to oil investments. So we're sort of used to oil investments over here too, but the Americans appear to have less of a, let's say, ideologically impacted investment stance over there than we increasingly have in Europe. By which I mean that after a reasonably long time now, certainly a decade, of problems related to climate change being highlighted in public discourse in, let's call it Europe in the wider sense here, investment guidelines have been solidifying over here, which make a unfettered investment in stocks held to be environmentally unfriendly more difficult over here than it is in the US. And that is sort of what he was highlighting. I think he was saying that investors are here restricted. I'm unsure whether that is actually the case. I do not believe, or at least I'm not aware, of any formal restriction to invest in inverted commas, dirty stocks, environmentally unfriendly stocks. But there is certainly a public discourse here which has resulted in a form of moral suasion not to invest in those stocks, or at least if you are, or commensurately, therefore, if you are an institutional investor of the likes of BlackRock or Fidelity, you might want to project a environmentally friendly image to your customers at large by being able to demonstrate that the investment which you have in these stocks is limited or at the very least monitored. So obviously there is a position in this sort of a gamut. I mean, you're not actually regulated against it, but there is a certain moral suasion against a pronounced investment in these sectors. And this exists in Europe, and this does exist in the UK, and it exists to a lesser extent in America. Now, the next step in this analysis would be to see what is going to happen in the United Kingdom in the next half year. We're going to have an election. I looked up some opinion polls. Apparently, there are only two parties here to vote for, which is Labour and the Conservatives. I didn't find any others which are of note. And it appears as if Labour is somehow in the lead here. I mean, I'm just reporting news. I wouldn't know. And so to the extent that you might believe that a environmentally friendly policy is perhaps more in the traditional camp of a Labour government than in that of a Conservative government, such concerns, such as they are, would be highlighted rather than dissipated. So in other words, what I read into this statement is more of a shot across the bow rather than an actual threat to actually leave the FTSE 100. But let's still pause here. The fact that the CEO of the most important, the largest component of the FTSE 100 feels motivated to make the statement that he might actually re-domicile in New York highlights what I would say unintended negative consequences of an overly environmentally concerned stance in the world of investments.
I mean, I suppose, to be honest, I'm quite cynical of the whole thing, right? I kind of think that he doesn't want to pay, or no oil company wants to pay windfall taxes. Secondly, I think that he sees the government as being in a weak position at the moment. The LSE, the London Stock Exchange, is also in a weak position at the moment. And he is using this as, it's much in the way that a football manager, although I'm not a fan of football, sorry to offend people, my rugby is my thing. But, you know, much in the same way that a football manager behaves in a ridiculous way in order to shift the attention onto himself, invariably, not herself, but onto themselves. I think that they're not performing particularly well, and therefore this is quite an easy time for him to stick the boot in. And he knows that he's not really going to get that much comeback but then again, you know, the fact that he is making this threat does show that it is possible in theory. But then again, you sort of think, is it though? Because, you know, there was this whole kind of Royal Dutch, you know, this whole dual domicile thing, and that kind of, you know, I don't know. I mean, the domicile was London, you know. So would they really, even if he put it to a vote, would it really get, even if he did, would it really actually happen? But anyway, I think it's just from my opinion, it's just noise. He's using it as a way to sort of distract from the fact that they're not doing particularly well, and so versus others, and maybe could do better in America, but it would be a big upheaval, and I don't think it'd be worth it in the end. But yeah,
I think you're right. And yet it remains noteworthy that he makes this comment.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Heard this type of commentary from CEOs of oil companies pretty much ever, to be honest with you. And the fact, I mean, this is always, it's a little bit, a dark art to actually really say that oil companies in the UA, in the USA attract better stock market weightings because they're averages, and the averages have outliers and all sorts of things. But by and large, it is not a silly statement to make. To the extent that it isn't, it will then, he hopes that it will be heard by the likes of BlackRock and Fidelity, and maybe dilute an anti-oil sector investment stance to the extent that it might be present. So it's a game of politics and a little bit of psychological one-upmanship here, which is being played. Especially, there's a practical issue which you already highlighted. I mean, there are two options here. If we really wanted to leave the FTSE, there are two options. One is, in fact, to leave and re-domicile, if that's the right word here, on the New York Stock Exchange, get a listing on the New York Stock Exchange, which would then be the only listing, or to actually have a dual listing. But dual listings are messy and they're in nobody's interest, especially not if he's correct and if there really is a let's focus just on one multiple price to book to make this specific. If there really is a discount between London and the US, and Shell would trade at a whatever 7 times price to book multiple here, and it would trade at 8 times price to book in the US. It's not in anybody's interest to actually highlight this particular discount, because then you have a discount between your two trading domiciles, which is only going to mean that it's going to be X'd out by people investing more in your investment in New York. And maybe the discount is there to stay, which is, again, going to be very negative for the stock. We've had these experiences. I've had these experiences myself with some companies which used to have a dual listing in European stock exchanges. And the discount was there, just stuck, and it never went away. And in every meeting I've ever had with a fund manager on that specific stock, we spent 10 minutes discussing this discount. So in other words, what I'm saying is, it is in nobody's interest, it is wasting time, it is non-economic anyway, and he really only would have one option, and that is to leave the UK and list in New York. I don't think a dual listing would be in his interest, and leaving and domiciling in New York only would be quite a large step, because it's a dramatic step. Because especially if you're right in your analysis, and he's just doing this a little bit as a smokescreen to perhaps also divert from valuation problems which Shell has. Well, if you say that is the reason, and then you do domicile in New York, and the discount then prevails against other oil stocks in New York, well, then unfortunately, you know, you have nowhere else to run. And so that is his risk in doing this. Nevertheless, I remain, I sit up, basically, and I note that he said this. It will be interesting to see whether BlackRock and Fidelity and all the other institutional investors are somehow diluting, to the extent that it might be present, their cautious stance on investments in the mineral extraction sector.
And I mean, you know, for what it's worth, I mean, I know there's a lot of chat about companies leaving the FTSE and listing in New York, or bypassing the FTSE and listing in New York, and everyone's getting all quite down about the whole thing. Now, all I would say is, it seems to me, this is not all of them, but it seems to me a lot of them that do that, either they're doing it, so let's say, Flutter and Entain, whatever, you know, the gambling companies, a listing in New York, I think, makes a lot of sense, because the UK market for them has basically died since the betting terminals that they used to have in the betting shops. Since that all went, and there's more of a crackdown on gambling generally in the UK, I'd say that that kind of bread and butter business is gone, and to be replaced by sports betting being made legal, increasingly legalized in America, suddenly that you know, they can really grow there, because they have the expertise, the online betting expertise that they can immediately bring to bear in a big market. And I think that they are doing so, that makes strategic sense, because these companies, like the gambling companies, they're going to where the business is going. And I think there are other companies as well who either by acquisition, like maybe buying a company or reverse acquisition or whatever, the way they've developed, suddenly the majority of their business is in America. And again, it makes sense to go over there. You've then had these, but so that's fair enough in my opinion. So all of those, that's fair enough. That's not the London Stock Exchange's problem. That is just, that's just the way when businesses change. On the other hand, there are stocks that I think have listed in the, you know, in New York, and they've been kind of rubbish. So I think was it Alex Chesterman, whatever it was, it Kazoo. I mean, what an absolute disaster that was. And I remember him, you know, leaving and saying, yeah, you know, the UK, no one understands this business. It's a load of rubbish. They're all, you know, the whole implication is that London investors are all fuddy-duddy old people who don't understand new stuff. And then they go off to New York, have a great, you know, 5 minutes in terms of, you know, an IPO that goes well. And then it just blows up in their face because they weren't ready. They weren't ready for the IPO.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that there's a lot of companies that come within those camps. So ones that make strategic sense, no problem with that. And then you've got other companies which are rubbish and go over. They're not fully formed. They don't deserve to be IPO'd. Mm. And they go over and they blow up in America, as in they literally die in America. So I don't know. I mean, obviously it is cause for concern in terms of there being less, you know, there's less to play with over here. But I don't know. I don't feel that I don't feel this is the disaster that everyone is thinking. So I'm fairly, you know, okay with relaxed with what's going on in the UK at the moment. I mean, we could do with a few IPOs just to get things rolling. And then once things do, I think that there will be more momentum, especially if we bring down, which is what it looks like, you know, interest rates come down here earlier than they do in the US, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly that could, you know, that in itself could really start to get the juices flowing on the on the corporate activity front as well. So, you know, well, I don't think
there's
that
one thing I'd like to mention, but it's a question mark. It's more a think piece. I would need to develop that a little bit more. So apologies. I mean, basically I should come here with answers rather than questions. But I can't help observing that the importance of the LSE, the London Stock Exchange, relative to NYSE, New York Stock Exchange, has diminished since Brexit.
Hmm.
I remember, I mean, there's always been this sort of rather infantile but amusing competition between London and New York and who is the biggest in the world. And New York always beat London, maybe not by a country mile, but they always beat London. And I think 1 year or 2 years before Brexit happened, that was the first year where London actually got the upper hand, and London was the most important global investment market for 1 year. And so we were doing well, but since Brexit, you see these the relative weakening of the LSE as a place of domicile for listings relative to New York. And I don't know whether that actually has something to do with it, but to the extent that the companies listed here in their business used to have access to the single market and now have access to the single market only in a restricted form.
Mm.
Now, to me, that must count into the rationale of investors to an extent. And like I said, I leave that with a dot, dot, dot. Maybe we can revisit this at some point if I have better data to perhaps corroborate or substantiate this idea. Mm. But there is something there which appears to diminish, at least relatively, the importance of the LSE as a stock exchange relative to New York And I can't help thinking that must have at least something to do with the fact that the businesses domiciled here in the UK have a restricted access to the largest economy in Europe, in the second largest or third largest in the world.
Mm. There we go.
the usual comment from the president of the Brexit Haters Club.
It's all good. It's all good. We're all good here.
You know who you are. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent.
So that's really good. So interesting discussion. Right. So I think the next thing just want to bring up here then is the subject of electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest, at the moment, the way things are going, all new cars sold from 2035 onwards are supposed to be electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. And everyone is supposed to be, all the manufacturers are supposed to be working towards that. And those who don't, if they fall behind, they have to pay, in terms of the quotas, they have to pay massive fines. However, I really don't think that this is going to work. I don't think that, I think instead of 100%, I mean, I would suggest it's going to be more like 50-50, if that. And there are a number of reasons why I think that EVs will fail will take over, everyone will be driving EVs for in 2035, for instance. Mm-hmm. So the reasons are, firstly, we don't have enough EV battery materials even now, and we're still less than 10% of overall, vehicles on the road around the world are probably around 5% or whatever, or not that far different to that. So we don't even have enough battery materials for that now. What is it going to be like when it's 20, 30, 40, 50% or more? So that's one thing. Secondly, I think that a big electric vehicle take up will put major pressure on the grid, right? So I suspect, although this has not been said, but I suspect this is why incentives have either vanished or been reduced substantially, because governments maybe realized that the grid can't cope, and so one way of making sure that things develop slowly rather than quickly in terms of EV take up is to not subsidize it, because if they subsidize it, you'll definitely get more sales. And maybe they think, well, if we did that, actually we might shoot ourselves in the foot, because they'll get all these cars and then our grid won't be able to cope with it. So there's that. The third thing is this rapid development of AI that we are seeing at the moment would require even more electricity as time goes on. And I think out of the two, if you were to think, okay, you've got EVs on the one hand and AI on the other, which one is going to be prioritized? I would suggest that it will be AI, because the benefits of AI could potentially be bigger and more widespread. And I think there was an amazingly apt, well, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think an amazingly apt illustration of that this week. So we've got Blackstone Group, which is buying British Volt's site. So remember, British Volt had this site in Northumberland that was going to be a battery, electric vehicle battery gigafactory. But now Blackstone is buying it for, what was it? So it's £110 million. And it is not going to use it for battery gigafactory. It's going to use it for data centers. So to me, that would suggest that long term, they feel that data centers that you can use for AI is the way forward, and not electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that I can ever see electric vehicles becoming really, truly mass market is when we have a when nuclear fusion becomes a properly viable energy source, because that way the restrictions on generating capacity and stuff will fall away, and our grid will be able to cope with it, one hopes. So anyway, so those are the reasons. I mean, I'm not trying to offend anyone who drives an electric vehicle. Everyone who drives them that I know loves them, and it's all brilliant. And to be honest, I'd quite like one myself. But I just don't think we are all going to be driving them within the next 5 to 10 years. But what do you think on this, Ralph?
Well, this is surprisingly complex, isn't it? And manifested. Let me start with numbers. Mm-hmm. You guys know I like my numbers. So just a few numbers relating to usage of these various technologies.
Yep.
So I see here in my all-knowing report, which I consulted, that the global electric vehicle fleet at the moment consumes about 100 terawatt hours of electricity. This is in 2022. So let's call it 100 in 2022. And it's projected to rise to around 1,000 terawatt hours by 2030. So we know the cutoff point here, the political threshold, is 2035, by which 100% of new production is planned to be EV. This projection is for 2030. But so that sort of means that in the minds of the people who authored this report, within the next 8 years, let's use round numbers, within the next 10 years, the projected usage of electricity by electric vehicles is going to multiply tenfold. So that's quite a lot. Actually, it's completely meaningless. It's just a number at the moment. But so let's put this into context and look at data centers. So I need to get this right now, not telling lies here. So currently, the energy usage of data centers, and this is the same year, 2022, is estimated to stand at around 500 terawatt hours. So the comparison is 100 for EV currently, 500 for data centers currently. And data centers are projected to increase, this says by 2026, but let's pretend this is sort of ballpark the same, to around 1,000 terawatt hours. So by now everybody's fallen asleep, of course, as usual when I speak. So I should have some sort of bell here, some football horn, to just basically, everybody wake up. Fantastic. Excellent. Everybody woke up again. So let me summarize. Oh, God. Everybody here is going, oh, no, he's going to say it again. Please stop. For the love of God. But okay. All right, fine. So I'm laughing about myself here. To summarize, AI and when I say data center, that means AI, everything internet related, not just AI, but everything internet related. So the numbers here include current AI data usage. Data centers currently 500 terawatt hours, in roughly 10 years time projected to double to 1,000 terawatt hours. EVs currently 100 terawatt hours, in 10 years time projected to rise tenfold to 1,000 terawatt hours. So if you add them up, then in 10 years time you have 2,000 terawatt hours electricity consumption by the two sectors combined, and currently you have something like 600 terawatt hours. So the question is the grid going to be able to support that in 10 years time? And in 10 years time, the two combined are still only going to account for about 7 to 8% of world electricity usage. So it is possible that we are going to have grid capacity to do this, but not without the construction of new electricity generating plants. And this is where all this is getting a little bit difficult, of course, because moving back to the data center usage, part of which was AI, the data center usage was relatively stable over a period of 6 years during this study. And the reason for that was that data center usage of electricity went up, but hardware efficiency improved as well. And because of that, the actual usage stayed stable. The problem with this is that AI usage in future is unlikely to be compensated for by a commensurately efficient increase in hardware efficiency. As we commented on many times on the show, AI is better. LLMs, large language models, are better the more data they're using. I know this is crude, but it is absolutely true. The more data you use, the better your LLM. And that simply means that with the increase of the use cases of AI in the future, the data usage of the AI portion within the data storage is just going to balloon. So this particular projection here, which says that by in 10 years' time, roughly, we're going to have 1,000 terawatt hours, this is all very interesting, but it's not going to be compensated for by an increase in hardware efficiency, I don't think. So you end up with a view which is similar to the one which you've already articulated, which is, to make it simple, we have to choose between one or the other. It's not going to happen like this, but let's just focus our minds on the dynamics so that we can deal with them and that they are simplistic. Let's say we have to choose between one or the other. Which one is going to win out? And you basically said, well, this is going to be AI. But is it? And because when we chatted about this before we came on air, I agreed with you, and I still do, but there is at least one other thing which we need to keep in mind. And that is that electric vehicles are going to contribute to the fight against climate change. These electric vehicles, which are projected to come onto the roads, are going to displace something like 10 million liters of diesel and petrol per year, projected out in 2030. And the question now is, which lobby is going to be more powerful? Is it the commercial corporate interests of investors in AI, Microsoft, Google, etc., or is it the political class, the policymakers, which will need to be seen to do something to combat climate change? And so I still would believe that it is probable that AI is going to win out if there was such a dualism. But the reality of it is probably going to be messy, that we're going to end up indeed with a slowdown in the development of electric vehicle take-up and a further acceleration of development of AI. And we can only have both in my simplistic world here, which I deliberately keep simplistic, otherwise we will never understand anything. So in my simplistic world, this is going to be offset only by an increase in electricity generating plants, which for now, before we have the magic white knight of fusion technology coming in, which for now is going to have to be resident in current political plans, policy plans to get more nuclear modular reactors, nuclear power plants, and of course also wind and solar energy online or contributing to the grid. So I think the reality is going to be that in the end we're going to have something materially less than the currently targeted 100% take-up of EVs by 2035. It's going to be 50%, maybe, who knows, but I think all I want to articulate is that the slowdown, which I also expect, is going to be not as clear-cut as the one which we outlined, because there will be the element that the national grid is already quite supportive of an increase of demand from electric vehicles, and there will be the offsetting impulse from policymakers who know full well that they're going to be judged on how well they're doing in order to combat climate change.
Absolutely. I mean, I just, you know, when you throw into the mix things like synthetic fuel, like developments in synthetic fuel, which can be used in existing vehicles, I mean, it just makes a lot of sense. I mean, I just feel that, you know, what's wrong with having a mixture, you know, like you have people running traditional cars on synthetic fuel. You have people with that, you know, the hybrids, which can run on both. I mean, that's even more amazing. And then you've got, you know, and then you've got pure electric vehicles.
And you have hydro.
Yes, that's right. Yes. And again, you see, you can still have petrol stations. You know, you don't have to rip all of them up. You can still have petrol stations. You can still have service stations. You know, that the infrastructure that has been there can be used. You know, it's not like it has to be ripped out or completely changed. No. You can change these things over time. And I think that that is a better, I mean, ironically, I think that's actually, surely that's better for the environment than just like sweeping everything out. But I don't know, you know, it's just a feeling.
Yeah.
I just feel that a mixture of a bit of old and young, a bit of, you know, the cutting edge and the existing and the refinement of the existing technology, I think is a more realistic way forward than just sort of chopping off what we've done already and then going forward with just electric.
Yeah, it seems to me as if the future is indeed going to be, as always, more messy than we were sort of expecting it to be. At some point, I think naively, I thought electric vehicles, that's going to be the answer to the issue. And given a phase out of existing petrol cars in whatever 50 years time, everybody is going to be driving around in electric vehicles.
Yeah.
But in 50 years time, the reality is probably going to be that we still have some old petrol cars on the roads. We're going to have hydro. We're going to have EVs driven by different types of, not driven, but equipped with different style of batteries. And all of this, of course, needs to be supported by an infrastructure, a fueling infrastructure. Some of it is going to be the old petrol. Some of it is going to be new hydrogen fueling capacity. Then you have EV charging stations everywhere. So I think the future, the transition period is going to be a lot more messy, a lot more diversified, a bit of this, a bit of that.
Yeah,
before,
I think so.
Some technology is, or one technology is going to become dominant. And to be honest with you, I feel like listening to myself, I feel as if I'm sort of spurning trivia because that's the sort of thing which can be expected. This is always what happens in a transition period from one technology or one paradigm to the next, during which we are not quite sure which one is going to win out as the most commercially viable, as the most environmentally friendly, and as the most, let's say, operationally implementable, if that's still a word, by which I mean, where do you put the fuel stations? Are they easy to supply, etc., etc.? And just as another passing thought on this, and links back to an episode we did on hydro. Yes, of course, just to remind everybody, yes, hydro is, of course, also beset with its own problems. Yes, because it needs to be manufactured. It doesn't grow on trees. It has to be split out. Yeah, great. It doesn't have to be split out from, it has to be split off water molecules, and you need electricity to make that happen. But as we highlighted in the recent episode, now we get the gold rush towards natural hydrogen, white hydrogen. If you guys remember the chromatic scale, there's all sorts of things, white, black, blue, turquoise, pink hydrogen. White hydrogen is the naturally occurring hydrogen in the ground. So nobody's been prospecting for this because it wasn't commercially viable or interesting to do that. But now that we're entering into this area or into this era of viable, competing technologies, it is becoming commercially viable to extract hydrogen from the ground as naturally occurring hydrogen, which does therefore not need to be manufactured through an input of electricity and splitting it off water, but it is already there. So that makes it commercially more viable, and especially at a time where you highlight potential inefficiencies or potential limited capacity of the national grid. Hydrogen cars, I think, are becoming more of a viable alternative, and again are therefore going to be added to the gamut of possibilities here.
Fair enough. I mean, as usual, Ralph, I think we've solved the world's problems.
Yes, we've exhausted the problems and our listeners.
Yes, exactly. So good. I mean, we've achieved so many things all in one session. So as always, Ralph, thank you very much for your contributions. Missed you terribly. Hopefully we can come back again next week. And thank you for everyone listening to us, and really appreciate it. And we will be back again very soon. So many thanks.
We will be back. Absolutely. Thanks, guys, for listening. Great. Wonderful.
Brilliant. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.